everyone, and welcome back to the New Plaza Cinema Podcast, the podcast made by cinephiles for cinephiles. Today, in honor of what film buffs lovingly call Hitchcocktober, we're going to be revisiting the 1956 remake of Hitchcock's original work, The Man Who Knew Too Much, starring lovable 1950s icons Jimmy Stewart and Doris Day. So be sure to sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode as the New Plaza Cinema crew delves into the film's most suspenseful production lore and narrative moments alongside Emmy-nominated documentarian and notable author Stephen C. Smith.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's a great pleasure to always talk about an Alfred Hitchcock film. When I first saw The Man Who Knew Too Much, it was on a Friday night, January 19th, 1973. My family and I were watching it on a black and white television in our basement on CBS television and thoroughly enjoying it. And had any of us Hitchcockians that evening suspected that it would be another 11 years before we could see the film legally, we would have been horrified because it was not available after that point. The Man Who Knew Too Much, the 1956 version that we're talking about today, was a part of a five-film bundle whose rights reverted to Alfred Hitchcock after a certain number of years. And as a result, the films Rope, Rear Window, The Trouble with Harry, Vertigo, and The Man Who Knew Too Much remake were taken out of release and could not legally be shown until Universal Pictures reissued them to cinemas in the early 1980s. The second time I saw The Man Who Knew Too Much was at Universal Studios in 1984 on the eve of its theatrical reissue. Now, there's a big disagreement among Hitchcockians about which of the two versions, and there were two versions, the first being the 1934 British version, in which we had Leslie Banks in the Jimmy Stewart role and Edna Best in the Doris Day role. Which of the two is better? Well, everyone has their own reasons for preferring the 1934 version or the 1956 version, but we're going to talk a little bit more about that today. This story of a married couple traveling internationally whose child is kidnapped is the basis of a tremendous Hitchcock formula that merges excitement, humor, suspense, and heartbreak very, very effectively. And we will disagree as to which of the two versions handles each of those components in a superior fashion. But for starters, let's take a look at the original theatrical trailer.
You're right, that was a gunshot you heard. That was the signal that brought all the trouble out in the open. It's a scene from our new picture, The Man Who Knew Too Much. As you know, Alfred Hitchcock has an uncanny knack for coming up with the unusual in entertainment. Well, The Man Who Knew Too Much can certainly be put in that category.
The Man Who Knew Too Much was part of a remarkable series of films Alfred Hitchcock made at Paramount Pictures under a very unusual contract that afforded him tremendous creative control, although there were concessions that had to be made from time to time. This run of artistic and, for the most part, commercial successes began with Rear Window. It continued with To Catch a Thief and The Trouble with Harry, which did middling business in 1955, but had a good reputation. We, of course, have The Man Who Knew Too Much, and then we continue on to Vertigo 2 years later. This was the third collaboration between James Stewart and Hitchcock, their collaborations having started in Rope in 1948 and then resumed with Rear Window in 1954, and Vertigo is going to come after today's film. So there were usual Hitchcock technical repertory of geniuses behind the scenes, and we're going to learn more about them today, people like Herbert Coleman and Robert Burks, George Tomasini, Henry Bunsted, and a composer by the name of Bernard Herrmann, among others. This is more of a globe-trotting enterprise that Hitchcock was favoring at the time, as many studios were in the 1950s, with more and more big-budgeted films taking on travelogue-like personalities cinematically. So this is a film that I think invites quite a bit of discussion. And I will be interested to hear what our guests have to say today. For me, it has a very awkward beginning where I feel it needs a little time to get into its, in the spirit of things. And I'll be talking more about that with our guests. I was watching the DVD the other day, which had a great making of piece in which Pat Hitchcock was interviewed. Production designer Henry Bumstead was interviewed. Screenwriter John Michael Hayes was interviewed. And there was this really charming, articulate guy who had all these interesting things to say about the film composer Bernard Herrmann. Now, I would be happy to summarize his words, but he's here with us today, and he can speak more brilliantly than I. I'm talking about Stephen Smith. He's a four-time Emmy-nominated documentarian and author. He specializes in Hollywood history. He's the author of music by Max Steiner, The Epic Life of Hollywood's Most Influential Composer, which was recently cited by Variety and BBC Music Magazine as one of the best books of 2020. He wrote a book about Bernard Herrmann called A Heart at Fire Center, which received a lot of research for the Oscar-nominated documentary on Bernard Herrmann called Music for the Movies. Stephen's been involved writing and producing over 200 documentaries for TV and other media, from The Sound of Music to about Martin Scorsese discussing Lawrence of Arabia to, of course, sex, sin, and censorship in pre-code Hollywood. Needless to say, Stephen, we are so thrilled to have you here at New Plaza.
Well, thank you, Max. It's a great pleasure to see you looking dapper as ever, and very excited to hear what people have to say about this film today. And although someone might say, well, why this film if Wednesday was Hitchcock's America? This film has something to do with America. It was partly made in America. It was really made in three places, and that was Hitchcock's base at Paramount, Marrakesh, and London. And I think 1955, to me, is the most remarkable year of Hitchcock's career. That was the year that he shot this film, that it was edited, that the scoring was done. I think it was finished by year's end. And he had just launched his TV series. It launched in, I think, actually October of 55, right after the film was shot. And he was so busy, and I'm so glad you mentioned all the people he was working with, his cinematographer, Robert Burks, his brilliant editor, George Tomasini, who later, of course, would cut the shower scene in Psycho, and so many others, Herrmann, who had only done one film score prior to this for Hitchcock, The Trouble with Harry, but all the right people came together, and that allowed him to make a film a year, and he was working on three movies at once. And going back through the papers on this film, I realized that when he was starting production on The Man Who Knew Too Much, the foreign version of To Catch a Thief was just being dubbed. That was two movies ago. The Trouble with Harry was still being promoted. That was his most recent movie. And he was prepping his next movie, you know, and doing and overseeing, albeit not having a great deal of involvement, but some, in the television series. And it's remarkable to me that a film of this scope, this size, with so many scenes, could be made as quickly as it was. And I think it's due not only to the brilliance of Hitchcock, but for his uncanny ability to hire the right people and how quickly and expeditiously they did their work and how well they understood what he wanted. So that's something we can talk about if you like.
Because I was surprised, actually, not that Wikipedia is the official source, but I was shocked that they listed the budget at $1.2 million, which is still only around $12 million today, remarkably inexpensive for a film of this scope with such major stars. But does that sound consistent with what you've read about it?
Wikipedia is a good starting point, but I would say far from definitive. I would refer people to the American Film Institute notes on films. Those are far more accurate, and the TCM site links to those. And, I mean, Hitchcock ran a very tight ship. He was willing to spend money where he had to on a film. The place he didn't like spending a lot of money was on movie stars. That frustrated him that such a large part of the budget went to the actors. That said, he was also very eager to have James Stewart and Doris Day in this film, and Hitchcock felt very strongly about casting Doris Day. This was not a situation where people said to him, would you cast this singer? She's popular. he wanted her, and he was right, as I think those who've seen the movie know. And he and Stewart didn't really click on Rope, the first film they made together, because I think Stewart was miscast, and Hitchcock was so focused on that movie's novelty of 10-minute unbroken takes that they just didn't really connect on that one. Happily, they made Rear Window in 1954, and from then on, they had a very, you know, close relationship, and Stewart was eager to work on this film. By this time, Stewart was also taking a percentage of film's grosses, and he and Hitchcock had the same agent. They had the same talent agency, MCA, which just a short time after this would buy Universal Studios, and Hitchcock became the third highest stockholder in Universal Studios. So he's not only riding this artistic high, he is becoming incredibly wealthy. And I think so. He felt very confident in the fact that the television series was so well received. I think you sense in this movie and the ones surrounding it a real sense of confidence. By the time you get to Vertigo, a sense to experiment. Even The Trouble with Harry, which he knew was not going to be a big commercial movie, he wanted to make it because he loved that kind of quirky sense of humor. So I think we're seeing Hitchcock in a peak period. And I have to admit, I can't say which movie is better because I think it comes down to personal taste. And the two versions are so different. The 1934 film reflects that snappy, swiftly paced, more modestly budgeted kind of British film he made, which I love. And this represents the glossiest, you know, biggest Hitchcock movie. And those are a lot of fun, too, especially if you can see them on a big screen like New Plaza Cinema and with people.
And we'll be talking more about the big screen aspect shortly when Dan Cahill discusses the look of the film. But Hitchcock, of course, was like any good British artist, was a master of understatement. And I remember him being asked one time someone was overwhelmed by the incredible quality of his 1950s films, one masterwork after another. And he just said, I was feeling very creative at the time.
Yeah, yeah. That's, we'd like to be understated.
You did. And there's a melancholy aspect to this film because this was the final collaboration between him and the screenwriter John Michael Hayes. They had collaborated on Rear Window, The Trouble with Harry, To Catch a Thief, and they had a falling out here over the matter of billing because Angus MacPhail, I believe, had worked extensively on developing the treatment with Hitchcock. And Hitchcock rightly felt that MacPhail did a major contribution to the structure of the film. Hayes felt he deserved or wanted single credit. And I believe it even went to Writers Guild arbitration, which was a big no-no in Hitchcock's book. So they never worked together after that, which is a shame.
It's true. And I'll just add to that that Hitchcock's producer, Herbert Coleman, who wrote a fascinating autobiography, and he's so accurate about so much and will admit to his own mistakes in his career that I trust him on this. He said that MacPhail was primarily working on the structure of the piece and John Michael Hayes was the brilliant writer of dialogue, and that MacPhail actually continued to work on the film after Hayes demanded sole credit. And Hitchcock said to Coleman, and this was typical of Hitchcock, if you crossed him, he said, do we have everything we need from him, Herbie, meaning Hayes? And he said, yes, Hitch, I think we do. And he said, pay him off, and I never want to see him again. And then let's bring Angus in. So if you crossed Hitchcock, you could be very well just done, and he was cut out. And Hayes had a different point of view on it, others, but I think that's what actually happened. But what's also interesting is that this movie sort of blows up the myth that Hitchcock was bored making a film, that it was all just mechanical because everything had been worked out to the smallest detail. That wasn't true. This movie was still being written when production started. And the first location was Marrakesh, and Herbie Coleman, the loyal, he was called associate producer, but he was really Hitchcock's producer. He went to Marrakesh on his own, talked to the people he needed to. They were thrilled at the prospect of Hitchcock filming part of this movie there. They just said, it has to be done well before Ramadan. We cannot be done. And that was a problem because they didn't really have a locked script at that point. And then in order to make those dates, they started shooting in Marrakesh before everything was really ready. And there were, as there often are on a big film, two units filming. And Hitchcock, Hitchcock loved to travel for publicity. He loved to see the world, have good meals, talk about how he did what he did with people. But he generally did not like filming on locations because you can't control them the way you can a studio. And I think Hitchcock would love the technology of today, because the thing that he sometimes criticized for, which are bad backplates or something, it reflects the time. But I think he was ahead of his time in anticipating how you could do so much work in the studio. He just, the technology wasn't there. But he did go to Marrakesh, and he shot first unit for a few days with Doris Day and James Stewart. And Herbie Coleman oversaw a second unit. And Hitchcock got all the key material done with the stars, and then they left. But this was right before Ramadan. This is like 2 days. And Coleman stayed behind to get the necessary kind of color shots, you know, the background shots, background plates, background images that they would superimpose the stars over for rear projection. And Coleman said that got scary because it was hours before Ramadan, and the government had soldiers with guns and rifles along the tops of the buildings because they were no longer wanted there. And they got out hours before they had to get out. And they were literally told, you have to stop filming now and leave. And fortunately, that was the most dramatic thing to happen behind the scenes on the film, because from there, the company went to London. And that, of course, was Hitchcock's home. He loved Britain. They loved him. They shot much of the Albert Hall sequence, but not all of it, at the Albert Hall in London. And that went very well. And then, of course, they did as much as they could in studio at Paramount, including whenever, and this fooled me until quite recently, I have to admit, but whenever you're in the Albert Hall and you're seeing a box or a smaller area, they didn't spend time, you know, using a facility that is one of the most popular halls in Britain and remains so, because it's not only used for music concerts, now rock concerts, but there were, you know, at one time sporting events and, you know, everything you can imagine, conventions. So it was really difficult to get to spend too much time in the Albert Hall. And I think they did a brilliant job convincing you that that whole, whatever it is, 12, 13-minute sequence was all filmed there.
You touched on some of the political themes, like having to make the film there on the eve of a very important holiday. There was some controversy about the portrayal of the Arab world in the film. Two interesting books by a professor by the name of Jack Shaheen, who's very critical of how the Arab culture is portrayed in film. He was not that thrilled with that opening scene on the bus where there was a statement about the Muslim faith. But what's fascinating in the book, Hitchcock's Notebooks, they quote some fascinating notes from Hitchcock, who wanted to tone down some of the original treatment of the Arab characters in that scene. He said, these are very out-of-date portrayals, because I think originally they were going to pay off the husband whose wife's veil had been ripped away. He said, no, no, you can't do that. And they were going to have Stewart's character make a big scene. And no, no, this man is a lot more worldly than that. So it was fascinating that Hitchcock was wanting to be more respectful of that culture.
I'm glad you brought that up, Max, because that's another really interesting aspect of Hitchcock for me. He is often criticized for a lack of logic or plausibility in films, or sometimes for having an old-fashioned sensibility. But regarding logic, he once said, logic is boring, which you could say is a bit of a cop-out, but he really saw his films as dreams that took place in realistic settings. And of course, why does Tippi Hedren go upstairs when she thinks the birds are up there? There's no good reason. I mean, you can take all the movies apart, but Hitchcock saw these films as emotional experiences, and he wanted people to be so emotionally involved that that overrode the logical side of their brain. But I will also say, with respect to what you mentioned about his changing of the script with respect to Arabs, he did a tremendous amount of research on his films to know the reality of the culture of people, what even things like clocks sounded like and what the chimes were like in places. I mean, he did incredibly journalistic research, had people do it. And then he would either use that as background or abandon that. But he always wanted to root his films in a real place, so that when things took on a completely sometimes surreal or extreme quality, he wanted you to at least feel that you were in a real place. So yeah, I think I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, and then the only other thing before we get to our next participant, Daniel, is although Hitchcock had a lot of control over his pictures, there was the Paramount front office he had to deal with. And I think this may have been in the McGilligan biography of Hitchcock, that Paramount actually insisted on removing a lot of the Cold War content from the screenplay because it was more clear in the original script, apparently, that these were communist figures who were involved in the kidnapping and so forth. Paramount was concerned about antagonizing the foreign market, so there were references to Hungary and the Soviet Union that were deleted. And in a way, I think that makes the film a little bit less dated in that sense, yeah. And a little bit more universal.
That's an interesting point. And to be honest, I don't know about that. I do know that if he felt something was really necessary, he fought for it. And Paramount, for example, you know, 4 years later, was very against the making of Psycho, but they didn't say, don't make this film. Hitchcock put up his own money, and Paramount did one of the great advertising campaigns of all time for that film, engineered by Hitchcock, but they fully supported him. So Paramount was overall a great place for him. They might have pushed back on a few things. Certainly the censors did even more than Paramount. You know, Hitchcock had to satisfy them. But Hitchcock, I think, enjoyed working with playing with the censors. And he did the thing that everyone did. He put in things that he knew they would cut out so he could secretly keep the thing that he didn't want them to cut out. You know, not so much on this film, but certainly on a film like Psycho. So anyway, so much to discuss about an interesting man.
It is. And the Paramount films of his have such an outstanding production look to them because Paramount had such a high quality of production and quality to their films. And that does tie into the visual look of the film. And that does tie in to our next participant, Dan Cale, who's going to discuss the photographic look of The Man Who Knew Too Much. Dan is an award-winning filmmaker with a master's degree in film and TV production from NYU. He has decades of experience working in screenwriting, directing, editing, and cinematography. He's a member of the Writers Guild. He's taught directing at the New York Film Academy. And finally, how cool is this? He conducted a filmmaking workshop in Morocco. Who better to talk about The Man Who Knew Too Much? Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you for the detailed intro, Max. Indeed, this is my favorite Hitchcock film, and one of the strong personal reasons for that is that I lived in Morocco for 2 years. I was a Peace Corps volunteer. I did not live in Marrakesh, but I visited it extremely often. So the movie has a lot of serious personal attachment for me. Before I go into the film itself, I have to spend a minute on VistaVision, a process that was created by Paramount, hence the mountain in the background. And the basic principle is that traditional 35-millimeter motion picture film would run through a camera vertically from top to bottom. And there'd be a reel on the top and a reel behind that would catch the film. VistaVision ran the film horizontally through the camera. And the goal was to create a larger frame in the negative. If you think about the geometry of it, it'll become clear, but I'm not going to get that detailed. This is incidentally the same technology that created IMAX, using a larger film size in 70 millimeter. Okay, here comes an explanation of something that will be mysterious to all American viewers. What is the bit with the blue paint in this chase scene? And I'll talk you through it. This is the dyer's souk in Marrakesh, souk meaning a small market. Dyers being people who dye things, such as these skeins of wool. They are colored and they are hung over the street to dry out. This presents a very picturesque look, and it is in itself a tourist attraction. I've been there a few times. It is quite lovely, especially when the sun is shining right through the wool. Now, what happens in the chase scene is that Louis Bernard, played by Daniel Julien, collides with a man carrying not paint, but blue dye for the wool. And he slips and falls into the dye and runs off with people pursuing him. Now, why did they do this? Well, Hitchcock's intention, and it doesn't take but a millisecond to go, oh yeah, that's a Hitchcock idea, was that the people pursuing Louis Bernard would follow the blue footprints on the street. Well, they never shot the viewpoint of the blue footprints on the street. I think they were in such pressure to get out of Marrakesh that they decided they didn't really have to have it. But that's what the blue color is all about.
That was fantastic. And I have so many questions for you gentlemen about, especially when we get to the music portion of the film and the Albert Hall scene. Just a couple of quick notes about the actors, some of the supporting roles. Dan had mentioned Daniel Jalin, who played Louis Bernard. He had acted previously for French filmmakers Jacques Becker, Sacha Guitry, and also the German filmmaker who came to France, Max Ophüls. He was in La Ronde and also Le Plaisir. And he's going to continue to act in France right up through his death in 2002. And the double-crossing British couple was played by Bernard Miles, who previously had been seen in several films by David Lean, in which we serve in Great Expectations. The wife, Brenda DiBonzi, had also appeared in a David Lean film, Hobson's Choice. And the very creepy assassin, Reggie Nalder, was a Viennese dancer and a stage actor. Apparently, Hitch's instructions to him during the Albert Hall sequence was something to the effect of, gaze at your victim as if you're gazing at a beautiful woman. So those are words to the wise.
I always do that.
I always knew that. That's a given, right?
It is. Yeah.
And then the friends who were waiting for them in the London hotel room included the veteran actor Alan Mowbray and Carolyn Jones, who will be appearing on The Addams Family on television.
And Hilary Brooke. We can't forget the lovely and talented Hilary Brooke is in that ensemble.
Thanks for mentioning that. And then Christopher Olsen, who played Hank, he did mostly TV work after this film. His last credit was in 1960. So, gentlemen, thoughts on the music? You had mentioned in the behind-the-scenes documentary, Stephen, that this was a pretty low-key Herman score.
Well, there's not much original Herman underscoring for a good reason. The centerpiece of the film is going to be a concert work. It's going to take place at the Albert Hall, and the rest of the film did not need much music. So the first thing they had to do on this project was decide what music are we going to use for the Albert Hall sequence. And Herman either introduced or was 100% supportive of the idea of keeping the original work by a composer he greatly admired, Sir Arthur Benjamin, who had written Storm Clouds Cantata for the 1934 Hitchcock film. It was reorchestrated, it was made bigger, and I think that's a sign of how he didn't have the kind of ego that said, oh, I'm going to write all this music, I get to show off. And it's also a sign of how much Alfred Hitchcock loved the music for The Trouble with Harry, which would be Hitchcock's favorite of all of his Herman scores, that after that one collaboration, he had so much faith in Herman, he didn't just hire him to score his next movie, he hired him to be someone that he couldn't cut out of the key sequence in the film. And they had really formed an instant bond on The Trouble with Harry. So yes, when it came to scoring the rest of the film, first they pre-recorded the music of the Storm Clouds Cantata in London. So it's all being done to playback, of course. And then they also scored, I think at the same time, the main title of the film. Which is a little almost concert overture in and of itself, a very short one. And then the rest of the music, the film was shot, edited, and Benny, as he would with all the Hitchcock films, was around reading the scripts, surfing the refrigerator at Hitchcock's office, turning up at all hours. He was always part of the production throughout. He felt that helped him write a better score if he could see how scenes were being shot and talk with Hitchcock. And then when it came to the final writing of the movie, Hitchcock had so much faith in him that he left the overseeing of the actual scoring, the recording of the instrumental music, which in those days meant hearing the instrumental music for the first time. He left that to Herbert Coleman, while Hitchcock left to, I think, promote The Trouble with Harry elsewhere. I mean, again, he had like three movie projects going at once, along with the TV show, but he felt comfortable enough to go out of the country and leave the last of the post-production, the music, to in the hands of others. So that's really all I can say about the music. It was a very happy experience for everyone involved on that side of it.
I just want to cite my favorite original music cue is when Louis Bernard emerges from the alleyway, grasping at the knife in his back, and Stewart sees him for the first time. It is some of the most intense Bernard Herman music I can recall.
It is. Thank you, Daniel. And it's a sign of how it's better to have music that's effective in where you need it than having a lot of it. Oh, and this is a chance for me to mention that for the very first time, the complete score, the Herman underscoring for The Man Who Knew Too Much, is getting what I know will be a spectacular modern-day re-recording, because it's being conducted by the very best person to do this, a man named William Stromberg, who has been doing this for decades. And he and his wife, Anna Bonn, reconstruct, restore with my colleague, John Morgan, the original parts, and they're recording it, I believe, in Scotland, and that recording will be coming out in the next year or so, along with another big Herman score. So it's nice that the interest has not diminished.
And then, of course, we have to identify the hit song that emerged from the film, although it's credited in the titles, as I believe, as What Will Be. We know that it's Que Sera, Sera.
Yeah.
Que sera, sera. Whatever will be. The future's not ours to see. Que sera, sera.
Yes, we've talked about Paramount's influence. Paramount wanted to have a hit song in this movie, and Hitchcock was in complete agreement because he thought it was logical that if Doris Day was going to play a singer, she should have a song. And there's the famous story that Livingston and Evans, who'd written so many Oscar-winning songs, standards, you can look them up online, he hired them and said to them, "Gentlemen, I don't know what kind of a song you are to write, but Paramount wants a popular song. Will you go write it?" And they thought about it, read the script, and they wrote several songs, including Que Sera, Sera. And Hitchcock heard it and said, "Gentlemen, you may recall that I told you I did not know what kind of song I wanted. That is the kind of song I wanted." And he walked out. As Herbert Coleman said it, and I love Alfred Hitchcock movies. I'm not knocking him. He was a complicated person, but he was famous for not saying thank you to people. If he liked a script, you know, he would say to the screenwriter, "Alma liked it very much." When someone did a good take, he would say, "We have it." And that was a sign to move on. So he was really almost deliberate in his withholding of approval. And there's a famous story Doris Day told her. The main story she told about this film was that she was a singer who became an actress. She, you know, was insecure about her incredible talent as a dramatic actress. And Hitchcock did not give direction if he was pleased with something. And day after day after day, he said nothing to her, and she was convinced that she was giving a terrible performance. And Jimmy Stewart even said, "Don't worry, Doris, he'll let you know if he doesn't like something." But she finally said, "Mr. Hitchcock, I'm so insecure, I'm feeling so terrible, I feel like I'm letting you down." And that's when he apparently said, "You think you're frightened, I'm frightened every day. When I walk to the Paramount commissary, I'm terrified. I'm terribly afraid that someone is going to say something hurtful to me. I'm a very frightened person, too." And after that, they got along better. But I think that is true of Hitchcock. I know that if Alma, his wife, who was, you know, the person who signed off on everything he did, she was very pleased with Vertigo, but she said there was one shot in the movie she didn't like that she thought wasn't flattering to Kim Novak. And apparently Hitchcock then said to someone later, "Alma hates the movie." You know, he just was so sensitive. And unlike Bernard Herrmann, who was just this raw nerve of explosion and emotion and tears and anger and positive feelings too, a very, very sensitive man, Hitchcock created that brilliant facade of calm and implacability. But I think that he had the same feelings that we all do. He was just a genius at keeping it inside.
One other Doris Day bit that I have to share is that she initially did not like Que Sera, Sera. She thought it was a crummy song, but it became the biggest hit of her lifetime, her signature tune. It won the Oscar, and I'm sure she ended up performing it at every live performance. You know, it's one of those things you have to do at some point in the show.
I think the world is divided into two people, those who love Que Sera, Sera as this whimsical, charming story of youthful innocence, and those who find it the most saccharine, treacly 1950s hit. And I remember when I saw the film for the first time and she's singing in the hotel room, I'm going, "Oh, Hitch, what's wrong with you?" But then when the song appears later on at the embassy, and it's that magnificently edited scene as Que Sera, Sera is being sung, and it gets softer and softer as we go up the stairs, you can't help but be in awe of this piece of music and how brilliantly Hitchcock used it. So everyone becomes a convert to Que Sera, Sera after seeing the film.
And there is, by the way, a very, very good book. It's probably about 10 years old now, called Hitchcock's Music. And it is revelatory, to use a word that Stephen has chosen for us sometimes, in how often the music plays a role in the plot. For example, Que sera, sera, we have to know that song from the beginning of the film in order for it to work at the end. And the other instances of it are just all over the place. He knew how to use music very, very well.
And this is a film about music. I mean, music being used to potentially assassinate someone.
Yes.
The film, by the way, was number 18 at the box office in 1956. So it did well, but other films did much better, as often was the case for Hitchcock's work.
But it made a lot of money, and everybody was very pleased with it, and it did well internationally, too. So this was the kind of movie that even later when he went to Universal and MCA would exert more and more, let's say, influence in projects. This is the kind of movie they wanted him to make, and that's why those later attempts to do the international thrillers weren't as successful, because North by Northwest, he had really done everything he could in this kind of film, I think, with those movies.
So I'm going to just stir up a little bit of argument.
Go ahead.
Love this picture. I feel he dropped the ball at the beginning in the bus scene. I think it is the most unexciting opening for a Hitchcock movie. After the titles, we kind of cut to Jimmy and Dora sitting in the back of the bus. I was expecting some shots of Morocco, the bus winding down roads through the marketplace. We go through the bus. We start off with the driver in his local garb. We see the couples, the veiled women, and then we see the Americans. And we don't see that. And I just felt it was a very uninspired opening, but then it picks up beyond that. Gentlemen?
I will just vouch for the authenticity of the background footage on the bus. I have been on those roads, and they knew what they were doing. They passed through the occasional little village, and, oh, look, there's a camel. So they got the background footage right. The rest of the stuff, not so much. But
for me, dramatically, this movie does not pull me in until the murder and the kidnapping, and then it finally gets to momentum. And Hitchcock liked to begin things quietly and slowly quite often, and it's very effective. But this, for me, I agree with you, Mac. I find it not an overly compelling movie until we really get into the action of it.
This discussion was facilitated by film historian Max Alvarez and cinematography expert Dan Cahill. Also, special thanks to Norma Levy, Marianne Tesler, Sean Moore, and Polly Rittenberg for making this podcast possible. This podcast was produced, edited, and narrated by Hannah Kavanaugh. Yours truly. Thank you so much for tuning in, everyone, and be sure to keep an eye out for our next live talk back on November 5th, which will cover the classic 1944 film noir, Laura, one of the first Hollywood films to actively tamper with narrative logic. It's going to be an exciting one, so be sure to check it out and RSVP in the link in the episode description.